Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, the FIFA World Cup may be football's biggest stage, but who really scores the biggest financial victory? Millions of Uber drivers, delivery riders and freelancers could soon gain stronger workplace protection. How a Cape Town manufacturer is turning waste tires into energy, and experts are warning that mid-year burnout is becoming a workplace crisis long before the year reaches its halfway mark. It's Friday, the 12th of June. The FIFA World Cup is now underway. Bafana Bafana in action last night, and already the tournament is as much about football than it is about money. For fans, I think it's emotion, it's national pride, and obviously wall-to-wall drama. But for economists, the question is probably harder. Who makes money from a tournament like this? Broadcasters, sponsored betting platforms, advertisers, tourism operators, retailers, they all want a piece of the action. But how much of that is genuinely new economic activity, and how much is just ordinary spending, maybe wearing a football shirt? I'm in conversation now with Emeritus Professor Yanni Rousseau, Honorary Professor at Wits Business School and Economist at Altitude Wealth. Professor, always good to talk to you. So we hosted the World Cup in 2010, long time ago. Looking back, maybe let's start there. What do you think the biggest economic lessons from that tournament were that maybe still apply today?
Jeremy, in South Africa's case, the hosting of the Soccer World Cup resulted in massive infrastructure expenditure. Some of the infrastructure expenditure we still use very efficiently today, like better roads in Gauteng, road upgrades in other cities. So from that perspective, part of the infrastructure spending to the benefit of South Africans up to today. What is problematic with all major sport tournaments of this scale, some stadiums are built in countries that are not often used after that, and it's expensive to see to the upkeep of those stadiums. In some countries, it seems to me that some of these stadiums were either neglected or even imploded. It might be easier just to implode them. But yes, on a net basis, South Africans still reap some of the benefits of the 2010 FIFA World Cup in South Africa.
Professor, many countries, I think, talk about a so-called World Cup economic boom. But how much of that spending is genuinely new economic activity, and how much is simply money that would have been spent elsewhere anyway?
Well, in South Africa's case, as I've said, we had big infrastructure expenditure that would otherwise not have been spent in the economy. That gave a major economic boost. And the tourism around the event is very important. It depends on the size of the economy. The tourism, in the case of South Africa, would have had a larger impact than in the case of the US, which is a much bigger economy than the South African economy, but nevertheless, the visitors to the country and the spending by those visitors, very important boost to the economies of those countries. From that, it follows automatically that airlines are a very important beneficiary of these major events, because the people come and go. They have to buy plane tickets, they have to travel between the various stadiums. So the transport operators, specifically airlines, a major beneficiary of an event like this. People go to places where they would otherwise not have gone.
Professor, albeit that the World Cup is being played many thousands of kilometers away from South Africa, are there industries that stand to benefit most from the tournament in spite of the fact that it's a big geographic gap?
Well, broadcasting immediately comes to mind. South Africans want to see these games, so broadcasting in South Africa will have a major boost. People go to public places,
pubs, restaurants, etc., to watch these games, share it with other South Africans, and therefore there will be consumption expenditure in places hosting World Cup,
I say hosting in inverted commas, World Cup events on big TV screens, etc. So yes, there will be benefits for different businesses in South Africa, definitely not so much traveling as in the case of the US, Mexico and Canada, but there are spin-offs in other countries.
I'm probably stretching it a bit, but do you think the World Cup might provide something of a boost to South African tourism if the national team performs well? Or do you think that effect is genuinely or generally overstated?
I don't see tourism boost to South Africa if Bafana Bafana does well in the World Cup tournament. It will, however, be very good for South Africa's general morale, our general feeling of wellness. If Bafana Bafana does well, it can unite the country, it can give us something to focus on, can help us to forget our many other problems, it can give us a new dream for South Africa, and therefore I hope that Bafana Bafana will make all South Africans proud.
Wow, a lot of responsibility riding on their shoulders. Professor, on a more global note, with growth slowing and geopolitical tensions affecting markets, do you think this World Cup might act as a temporary economic stimulus for certain sectors, or do you think those effects are too small to matter on the big world stage?
On the big world stage, it will make a difference. It will focus the attention. I mean, it's an event bringing 48 countries together. There are teams from 48 different countries in the world, so 48 countries will at least focus on a World Cup and not on the internal problems. I only hope this whole tournament lasts for about five and a half weeks. I can only hope that we get a peace deal agreement in the Middle East during that period. I must admit that the peace deal in the Middle East will do more for the world economy in the long run than a successful World Cup hosted in Mexico, Canada, and the United States.
And just a final question, Professor. When the final whistle blows in July, what would be the single most economic or most important economic indicator that you would be watching to determine whether it delivered real value or just, as you've referenced earlier, that month-long feel-good factor?
Well, a real value one will have to measure in a long-term effects after the tournament. As I've said, in South Africa, infrastructure expenditure on, for instance, road infrastructure that we still use today. My sense is that the World Cup will give Mexico an opportunity to showcase itself to the world.
Of the three countries hosting the World Cup, the Mexican economy is the smallest, although Mexico is a big economy. It's in the top 15 of the world. It's an opportunity for Mexico to showcase itself to the world. Mexico is often made out as an underdog to the US, whereas it's a modern economy with good tourism opportunities, etc. So I would look for long-term economic benefits in Mexico after the World Cup.
Yanni Rousseau, Honorary Professor at the Wits Business School, Economist at Altitude Wealth, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I understand that South Africa's gig economy may be heading for a major labor law shift. Proposed reforms could extend stronger protections to, for instance, Uber drivers, delivery riders, freelancers and other platform workers by broadening how employers and employees are defined. Now, supporters say this is overdue because many gig workers face long hours, unpredictable pay, sudden deactivation, algorithmic control, and a few basic protections. But I guess platforms are likely to argue that tighter regulation is going to raise costs, reduce flexibility, and even threaten jobs. So let's navigate our way through this particular particular issue, I'm in conversation with Sam Morotoba, who's Deputy Director General of Public Employment Services at the Department of Labour. DDG, welcome to you. So just explain to us the broad thinking here. Is the reform about protecting vulnerable workers, as I've suggested, or is government trying to turn gig work into conventional employment?
Thank you very much for inviting us to this discussions. I think recently we've seen a massive increase in of emerging employment in the gig economy. And internationally, there has been discussions, as you may know, that this year the International Labour Conference is dedicating its 114th session to deliberate on this new phenomena and to look at how best we can deal with the circumstances that the working standards, the conditions of employment, health and safety, social security, and so on, affecting workers in the environment of the gig economy. So we've had debates also locally with the various people who hold franchise licenses to these gig platforms. And yes, we understand the arguments that are also funded mostly by the originators of the platforms to try and argue for less and less restrictions, because the argument is that these workers are contract workers. But we've had discussions with the Uber drivers and quite a number of workers in the sector who have called on government to introduce measures to protect them and ensure that they have social security and other benefits that accrue to other workers.
DDG, one argument that the platforms will probably put across is that they are not employers but simply technology intermediaries. Why does government then believe that argument is no longer valid or good enough?
No, there are technology intermediaries or franchise holders of the technology, but where the origin of this platforms come from, countries like Germany, etc. Those countries have introduced laws because they've stopped accepting the argument that workers involved in those sectors are contract workers. And I think the outcome of the ILC will then give us a direction in terms of the convention that we can then use to base our laws on and to make the necessary adjustments. Remember, the workers, the employers, and the trade unions are part of the process at the ILC. And even locally, there was an extensive consultations and discussions with your take a lot, Mr. Deliveries, and so on, to try and say, look, yes, we understand this, the potential of the sector in terms of employment of people. But at the same time, we must also accept the erosion of labor standards that came with the introduction of the platform work.
Is there not a pure economic argument against the point that you're trying to make, which says that stronger labor protection simply makes rides and deliveries more expensive for consumers and also reduces the earning opportunities for drivers?
Not necessarily. We have seen during COVID, quite a number of workers were left out of the unemployment insurance fund, decided that irrespective of the contribution, those workers need assistance. And it doesn't mean that we can't have another disaster coming. And those workers are aging. And if they are not assisted, they're definitely going to become a burden to the social security system of the country unless we come up with a framework that will either force them or force even the platform holders to contribute towards such a social security. A lot of scooter drivers are being killed on the roads. What happens to the families of those people? What happens to their children? And what happens to them when they've, you know, they can't ride those motorbikes and they're confined to wheelchairs? Those are things that we must confront collectively.
Fair enough, DDG. How then is enforcement going to work when many of these platforms are global, they are digitally run, and are able to structure themselves around regulation? What's the plan?
I think enforcement should be seen as a last resort. We rely on the understanding from the different companies and the appreciation of the intention. A lot of employers are no longer forced to contribute towards retirement funds of their employees, the compensation fund and UIFs and so on. And that is because of the realization and the acknowledgement of the importance of these instruments. So we are hoping that the message will come across to this platform holders to see the benefits as opposed to waiting for someone to chase them. And obviously, the enforcement will be a last resort to those who are not complying. Yes, it will be very difficult, but where we have big companies that are trading with the state that want to continue operating, I'm sure there could be agreements which they can extend to other people that use their services to comply, and if they don't, to stop operating with them. So the convention that we are expecting will give guidance on a number of measures that member states can opt for in order to address this problem.
So let me just get this clear in my own head. Should these big companies not comply, you would threaten them with a big stick of not doing business with them and forcing other people to do exactly the same thing. That would be the approach.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying normally when we have such conventions and we enter into discussions with the main companies that are licensee or holders of the platform, once they agree and accept the principle, then it becomes their responsibility to look at other people that are using their services to comply. I mean, you can take the Uber, for instance. Once the government says, look, this is what we would want to do to protect passengers in your transportation system, Uber as a platform will then lay ground rules for the workers driving Uber, Bolt, Taxify, and so on, rules that they would have discussed and agreed with governments on the do's and the don'ts. And the traffic officers on the road will then enforce compliance to those that are not necessarily adhering to those laws that were agreed at those forums. I think the same will apply in other areas. So I don't think a big stick approach is the option. We normally use enforcement as a last resort, but we do engage.
Sam Moratoba, thank you very much indeed. He is the Deputy Director General of Public Employment Services at the Department of Labour. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa generates millions of waste tyres every year, and that creates a serious environmental problem and a fire pollution and landfill risk. But a Cape Town manufacturer says it's turned that waste stream into an industrial fuel source. The Get Metal Group says it's converting something in the region of 150,000 end-of-life tyres a year into 1.4 million litres of tyre-derived fuel, replacing conventional heavy fuel oil in its aluminium recycling operations. So the big question, I guess, is can this be replicated and also scaled? Ibrahim Khan is with me now, co-founder at the Get Metal Group. Ibrahim, a very warm welcome to you. So in non-scientific terms, how do you turn a waste tire into usable industrial fuel?
Well, thanks, Jeremy. I think the first part is, if I could explain the business logic around why we pursued the business in the first place. So we built the Get Metal Group with a core focus that it should be a circular economy business, which is effectively looking at the waste streams that we produce as South Africans, or let's say the carbon debt that we produce as South Africans, and to then take those waste streams and bring it back into the mainstream economy, as opposed to it going to landfill site or offshore, where some other countries are recovering the value out of it for the betterment of the economy. So that's the ethos and the philosophy around why we built Chevette Metal Group. To answer the question, we invested in a reactor system, a pyrolysis reactor system, and we deploy the tires into the reactor and through a process which doesn't consist of incineration, so there's no emissions from that point of view. It uses, in the absence of oxygen, hot air is blown into the reactor, and the molecule structure of the tires is then broken down. It releases oil vapors, and from that point of view, we are able to recover the oil through a condensation point of view. And the real impact around the recovery of this oil is the fact that we actually use it within our own group ecosystem. So we've transitioned away from using what would ordinarily be called heavy fuel oils, which is the derivative of fossil fuel crude oil, and we've moved to a tire-derived fuel. So when we are producing what we call secondary aluminium ingots, it's aluminium blocks made from waste streams instead of you using a primary supply, which requires you to dig into the earth through mining activities. We are using the commodities that's already been produced and recycling that into new product and using the oil as a fuel source.
Now, Ibrahim, waste-to-energy projects sometimes face criticism that they simply shift pollution from one form to another. Is that true?
Well, I think there's probably a nuance to it because there's obviously not a there's different types of waste-to-energy plants. I would say if you look at ours, you know, we're effectively taking what would ordinarily go to a landfill site, and we're putting it through a process where we're extracting the oil out of it and also the steel wire. So the steel wire we divert to our steel foundry where we produce steel billets from that steel wire. So I don't necessarily agree with the process that we're undertaking. There could be other waste-to-energy sites that could be doing it. But in our case, I think we're solving quite a key issue in terms of extracting the value out of the tires.
But the byproducts themselves, as you reference, are used. So the steel wire is reallocated, and as well, I imagine, as the carbon black.
Correct. So the carbon black, we use it in our truss or slag recovery processes. So we don't even refer to it as byproduct anymore. We, you know, it's a product that's being produced. So, you know, like within our business, we're always striving to find, you know, ways to actually extract the value out of waste streams that could be a product or could be a byproduct, and we use it within our ecosystem.
And Ibrahim, do you think the model that you're using could be scaled across heavy industry, or does it only work because of your specific aluminium and steel operations?
No, I think if you look at the Get Energy business, specifically the tire pyrolysis process, I do believe there's a huge commercial opportunity for it to be scaled, especially across the African continent. Because in the absence of having gas or reliable energy supply, you know, the oil can be used as a form of energy, heating, etc. It could go through a further distillation process, and it can be, obviously through a licensing process, can be used for fuel. So it's definitely a model that could be replicated, you know, where there's infrastructure and energy constraints.
What would you say then to manufacturers who might argue that circular economy models sound good, such as yours, but expensive and also complicated to implement?
No, I think there's you know, plenty circular economy businesses that are highly successful. We are one of it. And it all comes down to the ecosystem that you are building. So if you can vertically integrate different processes into your group, you can most certainly make it successful.
And just a final one, your model, if I've read the data correctly, diverts something in the region of 12,500 tires a month. Do you think you're making a big dent to South Africa's waste tire problem? The number sounds big, but maybe against the broader scale it isn't.
Yeah, I would say the in terms of making a national impact, no. But I think it's a start where this plant we've earmarked for replication throughout the country. And I think as we roll it out throughout the country, we'll be able to make a serious national impact. And so the journey is starting. So it's a starting point for us. And I think the main message is that there's most certainly an industrial activity that can be pursued to actually make an impact with the tire problem in the country.
And your estimate is saving around 720 tons of CO2 equivalent a year. How did you verify that number?
Yeah, so I think we use an independent calculation to verify that, and that's used against the use of fossil fuels. So that's how we came up with the calculation.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Ibrahim Khan, co-founder of the Get Metal Group.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
By the middle of the year, many employees, I would suggest to you, are not burnt out completely, but they are running dangerously low on energy. Ask yourself that question. That January momentum has faded. Deadlines are piling up. Economic pressure remains real. And the next proper break can feel a long way off. Now, the marketing agency Penguin says mid-year fatigue is becoming more common across South African workplaces. It shows up as mental fog, as lower motivation, emotional exhaustion, and reduced productivity. But the warning, I think, is that this is not simply about being tired. It may also be a sign that people and organizations need to reset before fatigue turns into real burnout. Annemie Berger is HR director at the company. Annemie, a very warm welcome to you. You're suggesting that mid-year fatigue is now a real workplace problem. It's not just a new label for being tired, is it? It's a real thing.
Yes, Jeremy. No, 100%. And thank you so much for the warm welcome. It seems like the year, I think every year, everyone says the year just goes by very quickly. But you always feel that you can kind of settle in from January, February. But we have experienced, and I think a lot of South Africans or people worldwide, is everything starts with such a bang. Where you normally start seeing people getting a little bit more tired and potentially a little more irritated around August, September, it just feels like all of that is happening earlier. And even though you try and manage it as best as possible, I think from a workspace point of view, I think people are just dealing with a lot. You know, it's not just about work anymore. There's so much more that's influencing people from a day-to-day perspective.
And as an HR practitioner, you are close to the center of this. What are the clearest warning signs that you're seeing that someone is no longer just busy, but is really depleted?
I think you normally see it in work output, people that's usually your top performers, that you can pick up. I'm not saying deadlines are being missed and things like that, but just the level of work potentially. And in general, their behavior often changes a little bit as well. You know, people just come in already saying, sure, guys, I'm tired. You know, I've already, by Wednesday, they feel like they've already worked for 2 weeks nonstop. And I think it's not that people don't want to work hard. I think expectations in general are quite a lot on people in general. And I think you normally, the first thing we would see it is a bit of change in behavior. You know, not normally the people that are coming in with a spark and a bit of energy and they bring that to a meeting. They are definitely, you know, you can feel it. You know, energies are a little bit low. People are a little bit more irritated. And just general people actually saying out loud, guys, I'm exhausted. You know, I feel like I just can't function every day the way that I normally could.
And tell us, how much of this do you think is caused by that workload that you've referenced? Or how much is it external? In other words, driven by real economic anxiety outside the office, which so many of us are experiencing?
Yes. Jeremy, I think it's a bit of both at this stage. I think obviously we work in the advertising and marketing industry, which by nature is a very pressurized industry. You know, things happen very quickly. I think with, you know, we know from a digital marketing point of view, the introduction of AI tools, timelines are just getting shorter and shorter. So people are expected to do more in shorter timelines because I think people think technology, yes, it does help us, but there's also a lot that goes into the creative process, I think in our industry specifically. But then, yes, the reality of, you know, where we're sitting from an economical point of view, if I just think in the last 3 months, the increase of the fuel price and how big influence that's had on people's normal income. You know, and I think money stress for all of us is probably one of, you know, people's biggest stress around how am I going to cope through the month. I think we all hear the statistics around, you know, people taking on more credit to just buy basic things. We're getting already a lot of requests. We're already in a hybrid working model, but can we maybe go even to a point where we only come to the office twice a week to help and save from a fuel point of view. So I think it's really both. You know, people are going through a lot. From a work perspective, I think employers are expecting a lot from their people in general, especially from a South African point of view. I think there's so much pressure on the labor market to keep up to date with global standards. And I think in our industry, we also compete with global agencies. You know, they love employing South Africans, and they're able to pay them in dollars and euros, which a South African company can't always compete with that. But yes, I think it's really unfortunately a bit of both. People have a lot of things that are influencing their energy, you know, being home, just being a mom and trying to get through a normal working day. And now you have extra costs because we all know when petrol goes up, food goes up. You know, your normal basic products are going up, and that stress is just constant. I think, and then obviously, yes, work in general is often very busy, especially this time of the year. So people are, they have to actually do a lot and be able to function properly. So you can see the difference,
Let me quickly circle
100%.
back to hybrid work. That's an interesting one. Do you
Yes,
think it
yes.
helps people manage fatigue, or, and I'm not a fan of hybrid work, I need to put that out there,
Yes,
or do you
yes.
think it's made work feel more constant and harder because it is so difficult to switch off?
Again, I think it's a combination. I must be honest with you, I'm also not the biggest fan of working from home and hybrid working model. I think people collaborate better and just you feed off each other at the end of the day. But I also understand this flip side of it. You know, it's waking up a little bit later in the morning and maybe not feeling that rushed and sitting in traffic potentially for an hour and a half or 2 hours, where people would log on potentially, like you said, at 7 now in the morning instead of 8 because they're at home. They can log on earlier. Maybe they get through a few things quicker because they don't have as many disruptions. I think that's often the one thing that we do here. People have less interruptions. They can focus on one piece of work a little bit more when they're working from home, and instead of constantly people walking up to you and maybe asking questions. But it's a balance. Again, you know, it doesn't work for everyone. We do have people that prefer coming into the office every day. And again, the nature of our industry is that people often do need to put in a lot of hours. But yes, I feel people end up working a lot later because, yeah, you're home, you have your laptop, you know that this deadline is coming. You are going to probably sit until 11 or 12 to try and get it done so that you don't have that stress tomorrow morning to get it sorted. So I think it's important for employers to acknowledge that and to try and put certain things in place to help your teams. You know, guys, you need time to switch off. You need time to take leave and not be bothered by work. It's definitely a culture that you need to create within your organization and be very intentional about knowing that we're already in a hectic industry that's expecting people to work over weekends and potentially late nights when there's hectic deadlines. When things quiet down, give them an extra day off, you know, before a weekend so they can rest for 3 days. We do have things like that, like a duvet day, and you get off on your birthday. And when people do work over weekends, we try and give them some additional time off. But yes, you know, your typical driven people tend to just keep on going. And you almost sometimes feel like you want to take their laptop and lock it away in the cupboard and say, just take some time for yourself. But yes, it's not easy, unfortunately, I think today's society and what needs to get
It's
done.
only early June, and I'm already exhausted from this conversation. I'm going to leave it there.
Yes.
Annemie Burger, thank you very much indeed. HR
Thank you
Director
so much,
at
Jeremy.
Penguin. Appreciate your time. Thank you. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.